You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Good morning. I'm Meg Riley in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Delighted to be with you for another episode of The View. As we close out the month of March, we're really excited to have the two candidates for UUA president who have come through the search committee, and they are Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, lead minister of the UU Congregation of Phoenix, and Reverend Allison Miller, senior minister of the Morristown UU Fellowship. And I'll just say, because it's complicated and I'm sure we'll talk about this, that at the minute, Allison is a candidate for the UUA president, and Susan is a nominee for the president. So stay tuned to find out what that means.
So yes, joining us this morning, I'm very excited because, you know, I have gotten to know both of these individuals through my work with the Presidential Search Committee. And so now there's a lot of people who are, this may be their first time getting to know them. We have with us the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray. She is lead minister of the UU Congregation of Phoenix, and Reverend Allison Miller, senior minister of the Morristown Unitarian Fellowship. And since I have, you know, since I had literally hours with both of you, getting to ask you all kinds of questions, I asked my View co-host for some questions, and so I'm going to give these to you, and I'd like you both to answer. First, what is your early memory of Unitarian Universalism? And then part of that, what was your childhood church like? And only because she is on the left side of my screen, I'll start with Allison.
Let's see, my earliest memory of the church school has to be just the feeling of being in classrooms with other kids and playing games and having adults really listen to our thoughts. And I don't know if it's my earliest memory, but I'll share this one. I remember being in a class where we were reading the stories of the Bible together, and each of the students would share first what we thought those stories meant. And then after the students each shared, the teachers would share last. And that sent a really strong message to me that each of our opinions mattered, even as children. And it was a powerful part of that religious education program. And let's see, what was the second one?
What was your childhood church like?
Oh, what was my childhood church like? Well, my congregation was started in 1819, so it is a very traditional building, and actually it's one of the congregations that was founded in the wake of a speech of William Ellery Channing. And it was a very dynamic congregation, and it grew throughout my lifetime from a mid-sized, really smaller than a mid-sized, congregation all the way to one of the largest in the association. And it was had fabulous music, fabulous preaching.
Where is this fabulous place?
Fabulous place is in New York City, the Unitarian Church of All Souls.
Oh, okay.
Oh, now I understand. Okay.
Never heard of it. Never.
Never heard of it.
And Susan, what about for you? So your early memory of Unitarian Universalism and what your childhood church was like.
So my earliest memory of Unitarian Universalism was from, I think it was kindergarten. I might get a little choked up. I'm trying to hold it together. It was Sunday school class with Tim Gardner and B.J. Limegrubler, who were members of the congregation. They were married. BJ was a widow, and so it was a second marriage for her, and her son was my age. We went to school with each other throughout our lives. And in that kindergarten class, BJ and Tim would sing songs, and we would dance. We would sit in a circle, you know, stand in a circle and dance and sing. And part of my you know, part of my story is that, and my family story was that happened to be a kind of tough time in our family. Lots of changes with my parents' relationship. My mom getting to be a part of the Equal Rights Amendment movement, them having to renegotiate the gender dynamics and power in their relationship wasn't easy. And that class was so joyful in a time when, you know, it wasn't, you know, in a time when lots of things were uncertain, that's just so close to my heart. And I feel like, you know, I wouldn't be who I am. I wouldn't be where I am if it weren't for those with BJ and Tim and various other adults in that community who really created a foundation of joy in my life. And
where was that?
So that was at Elliott Chapel in Kirkwood, Missouri, just outside St. Louis. And Tim Gardner is one of the lay leaders who's doing so much work around Black Lives Matter there at Elliott and the solidarity with Ferguson. It's been amazing. So I've anyway, Tim came to my ordination. I mean, all this, you know, just really strong relationships. So my church growing up was a suburban church in St. Louis. It was started by the First Unitarian Church. Some families came over and started the congregation. It was a smaller congregation when I was born and grew to be a large congregation as well over the course of my lifetime. And you know, the minister there's continued to be John Robinson, a mentor to me, and it was a loving, joyful, fun place. Lots of youth cons, lots of good memories there. Getting to preach there even as a youth was really powerful. I'm sure my parents say that was a big part of who I am.
Wow. And so I'm also, as a bunch of us are here, another one of those cradle UUs. And I'm curious, both of you, what was your experience like outside of the church? I mean, like, see, I grew up in Texas, so I have memories of being in kindergarten and, you know, getting the, but isn't Jesus your savior, you know, you're going to hell sort of things.
West Virginia, I'll meet you there, yep.
Yeah, I like, Meg, didn't you say something about how by the time you came out, like anyone telling you you were going to hell, you were just like, yeah, I've been hearing this my whole life.
it was the same thing in Massachusetts, too, you know, so.
Really?
Really?
Okay, well, I'll flip order. Susan, what was that like? Do you have any memories of that?
Oh, yeah, I mean, I have memories of elementary school being told I was going to hell because I was an atheist. You know, those are my early memories. And exactly, it was like, that's not a threat to me. I don't believe in hell, but okay. So, I mean, that's a crucial story. I think being a Unitarian Universalist, I think, gave me a lot of confidence in various ways to be secure in how I felt and in my views. Sometimes I was a rabble-rouser even as a youth if I saw things that were unjust, and I'm sure that had to do with being a Unitarian Universalist. But yeah, that was definitely even in Missouri, for sure.
I kind of wonder, you know, the Johnny Cash song about a boy named Sue, and you know, his dad names him Sue to so that he can get toughen him up. I kind of think that many raised UUs had that experience.
That wouldn't work if it was a girl named Sue. I just want to say.
What about you, Allison?
So, actually, a couple of things come to mind immediately. First, my parents, when they got married and when we were growing up, especially as children, it was still pretty edgy for a Jewish and Christian marriage to happen, especially on my mother's side, where they were very observant Jews. And often I was told it wasn't possible that to have a Jewish and Christian family, and that identity of multicultural family was often erased, questioned. We were often told there was something wrong with us, sometimes by the families, often by friends at school. And so the Unitarian Church of All Souls was a place where we were completely embraced for having different religious identities, as well as a strong Unitarian Universalist identity. A vivid memory that I have of growing up, some in the same vein as Susan was sharing, was the church had one of the first, well, the first, actually, AIDS task force in the whole country. And so we had these early bus campaigns about how AIDS is a human disease and it requires a humane response. And I was so inspired to see my congregation members on the front lines, the minister on the front lines, that I spoke out often in school. And it was a time when that was really unwelcome, but I felt so supported in stepping out and sharing accurate information about how HIV and AIDS was spread. And that brings me to a third memory, which is that we in youth group always said that our friends turned to us for the most accurate information yes. about sex education, that we were known as having the right answers. So I remember one day being tortured by a couple of friends who had been in CCD for not knowing all of this. But I remember well when they came to me to find out accurate information about
CCD is the Catholic after school training, by the way, for folks who grew up in that, which I did. It's I hear that story over and over, though, that, like, you know, who's the de facto sex counselor in the dorm? You know, it's the OWL graduates.
Right.
It's so awesome. Of all the things that we're known for, right, the yellow shirt people?
Mm-hmm. I can say it's 2019 that's still going on. Yeah.
I really felt like the first standing on the side of love campaign in many ways, I think. Yeah.
Earl Holt says that he was a UU for so long that in his childhood he learned about Jesus and church and sex in the street, and now that it's now it's completely opposite. Right? So, I just want to say that, you know, these stories of being the pressure from your schoolmates about your religious life. I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and in a white working class Catholic suburb of Youngstown, Ohio, and I cannot remember that religious pressure from my schoolmates. There were a few people, a few kids who came from more Appalachian regions who had, strongly expressed religious opinions.
Those are my neighbors you're talking about.
Yeah, I know those are your neighbors. I'm not calling them what we used to call them, Meg. I've advanced, you know, in my consciousness. But they had strong religious opinions. But for the most part, that whole, you know, pressure came later in history. That's part of the right-wing turn that happened in the 80s and 70s and 80s that wasn't there in the 50s and 60s as much. And most kids who did go to church went to Catholic or pretty mainline churches. There weren't big evangelical churches around at that period of time. So UUism was not quite so weird in those days.
That makes me think about the changing religious landscape that we're all in. And I'd be really interested. Joanna, am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah. Are you asking? Go ahead.
I'd be really interested in both of your opinions, and Joanna will know who should go first this time, about the changing religious landscape and how you think it is for our kids now and for our kids who aren't born yet even to come into this world and what you would wish for them in this changing landscape.
The kids who aren't born yet, are you making an announcement, Meg? Is there some sort of...
No, but, you know, Adam Gerhardstein just had a baby this week, so brand new babies are totally on my mind.
So I think, Allison, it's over to you for this to start.
Well, I would say that here where I live in Morris County, I'm seeing a turn towards religious conservatism, and it's been pretty palpable, actually. We're dealing right now and have been over the last decade how to support a couple of mosques that have been turned away, and so many people standing up and saying not a mosque in our town, and not being shut down for religious bigotry. Or we have a tradition in our community of sharing an interfaith service at the Baptist church in town, And a couple of years ago, we were told that only Orthodox Christians were allowed to speak at that service. And so we've been working really hard as a community to really to learn about one another's faith traditions. The Unitarians, I have to say, have been playing the role of bridge building and sharing our knowledge not only of our faith but of other religious traditions. And slowly but surely, this year we had youth speak from the pulpit of the Baptist Church representing different faith traditions. And I'll know that we've arrived at a much better place when we actually are allowed to have faith leaders from all of the religious traditions speak in that pulpit, hopefully next year on Martin Luther King Day, as it was when I first arrived. And a second example of that right now is we are now entering the 18th month as of Monday night of public hearings for our renovation and expansion of our facility. And the neighbors are saying so many things that you might put under the category of not in my backyard. They've made requests that we shut everything down except for Sunday mornings, that we get rid of not allowing alcoholics to come in the morning for their meetings around recovery. I've had people, neighbors have gotten up and said, will this mean more gay weddings? It's been pretty intense. I'll just share that Morris County is where Chris Christie lives, just a few like 3 miles from where I am right now, and it's a religiously conservative area. And so what I would love to see, and I think about my son who's 4 and the children not born yet, as Meg is sharing, I would love to see Unitarian Universalists share how it is that we're able to gather together as one community with so many diverse beliefs and create spaces that are sacred, that are peaceful, that are joyful, and that are pushing forward justice in the world with our neighbors, and that this could be a powerful influence that we might have in the community, so that as Asher becomes a teenager, there will be much more understanding and a spirit of collaboration between the religions.
And Meg, I'm going to ask you to repeat your question for Susan.
Sure, Susan, just saying in this changing religious landscape, you know, what do you think it's like now for kids, and what do you hope for kids in the future and growing up Unitarian Universalists, what do you hope that the congregations feel like for them?
So I think it's, I mean, we are certainly seeing in Phoenix, honestly, violent threats towards our Islamic communities here. And we've worked with interfaith partners to try to stand together for love with those communities and congregations. I think it's still a question of what this rise of the nuns and non-religious people, the impact that that will have across our society. And I do hear from our youth, I get a sense that while they still have some of the same things that that some of us named about, you know, how can you be religious if, you know, or if you, I think that's a criticism they get as Unitarian Universalists. How is that a religion? But I do also get a sense that there are a lot of folks who just aren't connected to religious community, and they may have an understanding of, or I think they have an understanding of what religion is, but are not necessarily religious or practicing. You know, it's interesting what John Dorhauer, who's the new president of the United Church of Christ, has been saying. I think he's been talking with Peter about this, that increasingly religious liberals of all stripes, so Jewish, Christian, UU, Muslim, you know, various groups are going to be more similar than their conservative counterparts within the same religious tradition. And so increasingly trying to build partnerships across liberal religious people, across faith, how important that will be to offering and supporting and naming a more liberal and broad and welcoming religious future for our communities and for our young people. So I think we're in the midst of a lot of change with the rise of the nuns. I would like to see our congregations be religiously relevant, spiritually deep, offering people what they may not realize is missing in not tending to your spiritual life and your sense of connection. And because I think that that's an important moral force in our world. It's an important force for opening our hearts and compassion and teaching the values of compassion and respect. So I want to see our faith continue to be strong, but I'm also just watching, I think we'll all be watching what happens as these nuns and increasing nuns come of age and raise children. That it may be that we all need to work together on that liberal religious continuum to try to promote a sense of tolerance and then the depth of religious experience. Yeah.
It's interesting. Just can I say that to look at these answers here and then kind of look at the flow on these things. If you had asked people a while back, maybe 10 years ago, about the religious landscape, you would have heard talk about the radical religious right. Mm-hmm. And then for a while, we were talking about the nuns. And Allison points out, which is also what we see, is that actually what we're looking at now as the kind of cutting edge issue in religious landscape is this rise of Islamophobia. And how that is like a direct challenge to liberal religious values, or our commitment to religious pluralism. It's interesting to see how these things kind of move along. Because I think the nuns, you know, the rise of the nuns is also a rejection of the kind of conservative elements that we see. You
absolutely.
Know, they, you know.
Yeah, and I imagine we'll see more of it. So Tom had mentioned, and Susan, I'm going to start with you on this. Tom had kind of pointed out differences in experience, and that perhaps there's some generational differences. Tom being a boomer, and both of you are what is called Generation X, and the last four UUA presidents have all been boomers, right? So how will your outlook as a Gen Xer be different from these previous presidents?
Well, I think, you know, the use of social media and technology to connect and to be in communication with our larger association and our leaders, like that's a change that I hope happens with the next presidency. I know some of that is happening, but I think we've just scratched the surface on what's possible in drawing people together, being in collective discernment about the future of our faith and where we go. So I hope that one of the things that a Gen X leader will bring is really strong skills in social media, communicating who we are to the world, communicating who we are and where we need to go among each other. So that's one thing. We're in a time of tremendous change. In fact, we've been in a time of tremendous change for several decades. Technology's been a big piece of that change. So I think that, while we're not millennials, and they've been raised, you know, even more with technology, that a Gen X leader my hope is that we'll be able to say, how can this institution be an institution for the 21st century? And what are the changes we need to make so that we can be adaptive and flexible and actually have an impact in the 21st century, not be left behind?
Yeah. And Allison, what about you? How do you feel that your outlook as a Gen Xer is going to be different from previous UUA presidents?
Well, I would say that when I graduated college, one of the things that I remember was that the newspapers at the time, when we still read newspapers, said things like, this is the first generation that is going to be worse off than their parents. And I recognized that that was a limited perspective, probably mostly looking at the middle class. But at the same token, I think that we have, when we were young adults and when we were youth and all the way through our adulthood, lived at a time where things we used to be able to count on were no longer working. And so I feel growing up as a Gen Xer has equipped us to be practiced at dealing with uncertainty and to be comfortable with dealing with uncertainty. And I think in order for our faith to remain relevant and engaging, we have to be comfortable with taking risks, and that part of being successful and helping people connect with our message, both within our congregations and outside of our congregations, involves a willingness to fail, to learn from failure, and of course to learn from success as well. And I think a number of us have been engaged in that for years. I feel so much gratitude for having been raised a Unitarian Universalist in the youth movement, and then to have been an active leader as a young adult. And I see so many things that we were deeply engaged with, like the work of anti-racism and anti-oppression, that now has captured the mindset of our whole denomination. And so I think Gen Xers are practiced at stepping out into uncertainty and recognizing that it involves some mistakes, a need to learn, and that through that we can actually have incredible success and be much more relevant than we were. And then I'll add one other thing. I echo everything Susan said about social media. I think that's absolutely correct. And the use of technology, and Gen Xers are comfortable with technology. And I'll add this, which is that as parents of those of us that are parents of young children, I think that we have an opportunity to really lift our faith up as a generational faith, and to both look backward at the heritage that we've received and to be able to see forward into imagining a faith that will serve not only our kids, but the youth that are engaged in our churches or even outside of our churches, hungering for what we have to offer. And I think there's a real opportunity as parents to talk about the spiritual lives of families and children that will serve us into the future.
I have a question. Would you say, I'm also a Gen Xer, would you say that Gen Xers are less attached to the idea of a hierarchical paradigm, that we're more collaborative, especially in the work world? Is that something either of you or both of you are seeing? How is that playing out in the congregations that you both lead?
Do we have an order, or should we just jump in?
Yeah, I think, what, Allison starting first this time?
Yeah.
Okay. I actually have been thinking about this a lot, especially having grown up in the church, and I want to lift up actually the service that I led at General Assembly, because one of the things that I thought about was how much the ministries that we offer, both in our congregations and in Unitarian Universalist institutions, is about shared ministry. And so it was really important to me that I honored that in that worship service. So I had parish ministers, associate ministers, I had lay leaders, I had ministers involved in music, I had directors of religious education, I had people engaged in Black Lives Matter, I had retired ministers, and people of all different ages and backgrounds. And to me, that is where our power and strength comes, that through shared ministry, each of us magnifies what we have to offer. And that's what I experience in my congregation and in the communities in which I move. And actually, I'll mention one last thing on this topic, is that I'm so grateful for my experience growing up, because I started out as what was called the church school sexton, which means that I set up all the classrooms on Sunday morning and then broke them apart. I've been an RE assistant, I've been in the administrative world, I've been a minister, I've been, you know, all over development, religious education, youth and young adult ministry. And I really recognize that every piece matters. And when you honor every single piece that is part of that whole community, there is so much that is possible if you honor shared ministry in that way.
My first job was washing dishes at coffee hour at church. Maybe it's why you're in a better church than I am. You started up as the custodian, and I started up as the dishwasher.
Well, I have to wash the dishes for the RE classes, but yes.
I think I'm muted. Sorry. Can you hear me? Okay. So I think you're, I lift up two things to your question about whether or not Gen Xers are more collaborative in their approach. And I think we have to be careful about generalizations. There's obviously lots of collaborators among boomers and, you know, more hierarchical narratives among Gen Xers. But I do think that there is, and it could be some of the uncertainty that Allison was talking about, that we've grown up with more uncertainty, that, you know, increases our willingness and desire and sense that we need to talk with others to shape our thinking. I also wonder if some of it's gender related. So in all my ministries, I've experienced a lot of collaboration, but I'm also a female minister. So I don't know how much of it is gender, and there's some intersectionality around that. And we have more female ministers in our faith than in other faiths, and that's been happening since the 70s. So in this same generational shift, you have more women in leadership, and that could be shaping the way we lead and the way we run our congregations in ways. So I definitely think there is a lot of collaboration among Gen Xers. I experience that. I think we don't want to just be in competition with each other. We want to model a different way of being and understanding that we need all of our voices to understand the challenges of the day and to make good decisions and good steps into the future. So maybe both a little bit of gender and Gen X.
So Susan, that's a perfect segue for the next question that I had. I'll start with you, which is, because you just talked about, you know, we don't want to be in competition with each other. The two of you are good friends. Is it weird to run against each other?
I think it's weird to run against each other. I also think it's an opportunity. I think Allison is fantastic, and she is a dear friend, and I, you know, and she would make a great president. And I think I would make a great president, too. You know, and I hope that the conversation we have helps us as a faith move forward. And Allison and I have talked about this even before we were nominated, about this possibility and whether or not we thought we could do it and maintain the integrity of our friendship, and whether or not it could help model a different way of being for our association. So, but and it is hard. I mean, at the same time, it's just interesting to be kind of in this, you know, you're forced competition with one another with a very good friend. But I'm excited to be in this campaign and hope that, you know, we really get to offer a compelling vision for the future and the various skills that we'll bring to that.
And Allison, what do you think?
Well, I want to echo a lot of what Susan said, and she and I have talked about this, and it is hard. I mean, it's hard to be campaigning against a friend, but at the same time, Susan and I have had many late-night talks about the well-being of our faith together, so now we have a chance to have this this conversation that we've been having and to facilitate it with all of you, and so that feels powerful. And I'll say this, boy, with the other presidential election going on at the same time, this just feels like a low-hanging fruit opportunity to model a much better way. And together, I think having the dialogue that's able to be fostered, I hope what comes out of it is a vision for Unitarian Universalism that serves all of us well. And so I think Susan and I have an opportunity to be engaged in that work together as partners as well as competitors.
Okay. Bob, I cut you off. Did you have a comment?
Oh, I just wanted, there's a comment on our online chat about the Gen X in which Sean Neil Barron says, I'm sure a Gen X leader will change the length of committee meetings.
Do I need to respond or just?
I'm just leaving it there. No need to respond. I think it makes its own.
Amen and blessed be.
Right. I'm doing the youth snap, right?
May it be so.
We'll hear a lot more of the music of the 80s and the 90s. Maybe the next hymnal will have music from the 80s.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so going from that to a more serious question, and Allison, I'll start with you. What is the UUA's role in supporting the Black Lives of UU and the Black Lives Matter movement?
I think that it's extremely important for the Unitarian Universalist Association and the president to pay attention to how we move our values out into the public square, as well as how we support Unitarian Universalists who are part of our congregations or finding themselves on the outside of our congregations but wanting, but who resonate with Unitarian Universalism. So Black Lives Matter is an opportunity that we have right now to engage with. It directly relates to our understanding of the first principle about the inherent worth and dignity of every person. I think saying that today is to say Black Lives Matter. I would love to see the Unitarian Universalist Association be strategic in how it supports staff that are helping support this movement so important to anti-oppression work. And I'll say this, I've reflected with some sadness how we've defunded the work of anti-oppression. And I've wondered if we had kept up that anti-racism efforts that we had started when I was a young adult, all the way through to today, rather than starting it up again, although there have been people who carried the banner the whole time, the funding has been severely diminished. I wonder what we could do. But that's no excuse for not forging ahead. And I'll just lift up one thing. My partnership with this, I serve as president of the Church of the Larger Fellowship, and one thing we talked about as a board was funding and supporting a Black Lives Matter organizer, which we're doing right now in 2016.
Oh, great.
So I would love to see the Unitarian Universalist Association do something similar. And I'll just mention one last thing, is that, again, to turn it back to our interfaith partnerships, I think that our outlook really lends us to be engaged in the world as partners with our faith, with other faith communities. And so I've been engaging in Morristown and in the surrounding area with the Black churches and with the NAACP and finding out what are the ways that our community could be most supportive in terms of the goals we have locally here. And so I've been a real ally and supporter of how police officers are being trained and around reduction in the use of force of police officers. That's been a major goal that's come out of the local racial justice and Black Lives Matter movement here. So those are a few thoughts about that topic.
Could you ask the question again?
Let's see. Okay. What is the UUA's role in supporting Black Lives of UU and the Black Lives Matter movement?
So I would echo what Allison said. I think it's critically important. And I think that we do need to be strategic about where we put our resources so that, I mean, we need to be clear about our vision for the association as a multicultural, multiracial, religious community across the nation, across the world, committed to justice, and so we need to fund those priorities. And I agree with what Allison said about the cuts that have happened and the ways that we've undermined that, and how that affects our ability to have an impact around these issues. You know, one of the things for Unitarian Universalists I think is so important is that a lot of religious communities do social service work. Julian Bond had this great quote that, you know, if we had social justice, we wouldn't need social service. Now, you know, I don't know that we'll ever end poverty and not need social service, but lots of religious communities do social service work. We are one of the few religious communities that does social justice work. And so I think that, like, emphasizing that that is how our mission and our faith calls us to be in the world, in solidarity, in partnership for racial justice, to stand and say Black Lives Matter and to partner and support and walk with and march and witness with Black Lives Matter leaders is critical on an associational level. I was thinking about this with standing on the side of love and reflecting on the work here in Arizona and SB 1070, and one of the most critical things that happened was that standing on the side of love sent staff to Arizona. You know, and here, you know, I'm solo minister in a mid-sized congregation, and this huge national thing is happening, and the UUA and Standing on the Side of Love came and helped. And what we did, I couldn't have done that alone. You know, it was because they came and supported. So what if Standing on the Side of Love had organizers that you could deploy in critical moments and support on the ground work and support the congregations that are providing leadership and actually put organizers on the ground? So I'm so excited about CLF doing that, and I've talked a little bit, you know, I mean, I think that that's something we should look at for Standing on the Side of Love. How can we deploy association resources to help congregations that are partnering in powerful ways and supporting movements on the ground? We can't be silent on this issue. It can't be this.
Right. So, Tom, I know you have a question. We'll start with Susan and then Allison. Oh, can't hear you.
My question just kind of follows from that: is how we make ourselves present in these social movement situations, especially when things are at a high level of conflict and contradiction, you know, like around SB 1070 in Arizona, or around Black Lives Matter now in Minneapolis. One of the things that, you know, I think we UUA generally tends to say the right thing, but about a week later, and in long, chunky paragraphs filled with lots of very carefully wordsmithed phraseology, it's like the world nowadays communicates in on Twitter, and our communications are have no snap, no crackle, no pop, no immediate relevancy. They sound like they were you know, spent in like, 20 days in a committee somewhere before they come out. I'm just asking you as like just one Unitarian Universalist who cares about this stuff, can you see a way that you can change that, that we can be more direct, more snappy, more immediate about how what we think about things, about how we put our social values in there, that we can comment from the top? People wait for something from the UUA, and it comes so late and so bland. Please.
Thank you, Tom. Yes. Can we get there? I hope so. I mean, one of the things can we get there? I hope so. I believe we can do it, and I think we need to. We could talk about what happens at General Assembly, because we model that exact same thing at General Assembly. Like, we need to have 3 hours of debate on an issue that we're going to vote for, but we want to argue this one word, so it's all polished, and none of that feels like justice work to me. None of that feels like impactful time spent. Some of it, I think, has to do with empowering leaders to lead, right? So not everything has to be workshopped. I mean, something, you know, be in partnership, be in solidarity, so that your message is echoing the message of partnerships and communities on the margins who are leading the efforts, yes. But it doesn't need to be workshopped by everyone to be out there. The other thing with social media, not just do we communicate quickly, but things come up and they go down. You know, I mean, it's more important to say something, it's more important to respond immediately than to have it be perfect, because another response is going to come in a minute. And so I think that we should look at our overall processes as an association in terms of how we do justice, because I think it's very heavily process-oriented and not organized for impact. So, and to make those changes, we need an organizer to kind of help move, communicate why we need to make the changes, and some of those changes are going to have to be decided on by General Assembly if you're talking about what we do when we're all together. And so organizing support for those kinds of changes so our time together can be more impactful is important. As far as the UUA, I mean, I think that the president needs to be able to just speak quickly and, you know, take mistakes and take fallout. It's okay. Here in Arizona, so Donald Trump was here, And there was a coalition of folks wanting to shut down the Trump event, inspired by Chicago, inspired by other communities, and to say, you know, and for us, it feels like his rhetoric is coming right at the same time when all these anti-immigrant legislation is coming. So all of a sudden, it's okay in Arizona to attack the immigrant community. And, you know, it was a hard decision. I didn't have a lot of time. It was like, we need a faith presence. So you started your question, Tom, I think, about where, how do we show up, at least was one piece I heard you ask. And, you know, these groups coming together to shut down the event wanted a faith presence to stay spiritually grounded. They wanted things to be peaceful. And I and others, including African-American ministers who were part of Black Lives Matter here, showed up. And, you know, we took some flack as faith leaders showing up to an anti-Trump thing, right? I wasn't there for my congregation. I was there personally. But I think there's times when you know what's right and you know where our values and our morals call you, and you act faithfully, prayerfully, and you have something to offer. And it doesn't have to be perfect. We have to show up.
What are your thoughts, Allison?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, I do think that the president's role as really making sure that our voice is heard in the public square is vital. And so one thing that I imagine is having a social media director who is supporting the president being responsive right away. And that really needs to be someone's role these days. Not just one person, but nonetheless one person who is paying attention to the Unitarian Universalists Association's response to all kinds of things, and not all. Sometimes it's the crisis of the day, and sometimes it's an opportunity also to reflect on what are the spiritual questions we have as Unitarian Universalists. Mm-hmm. The second thing, and I want to lift up, Susan brought this up, is that I think that spiritual leadership is so vital in these movements, and people are out there. Their hearts are broken, and they're looking for the good word. And so I find I was just on a pilgrimage between El Paso and Juarez, and with We Belong Together, an immigrant rights coalition from across the country, a national coalition. And actually, we had people who were stopped at the border coming back, and one woman was taken behind for questioning and was incredibly frightened, and they made jokes about her being a criminal, and that was why she was being detained. And what I needed to be able to do was to be able to pray with her and that whole community in the moment. There wasn't time for it to go through seven different iterations. The presence was what mattered the most. And I think part of this going out into uncertainty is being willing to make mistakes. And part of it is being invited. Here locally, it's often been communities of color that have asked me to step forward as a minister in the community, as an ally, and to say something. And because I'm in relationship with them, and we have a level of trust, they will tell me where I may have strayed from the message. And so then I get back up and I share my learnings. I share that this is a learning journey, the creation of justice. And I want to add one last thing, which is the other side. I think that the emphasis has been on public witness. And I also want to lift up that public witness is strengthened when we're also engaged in the long haul work of change. Mm-hmm. Serving on the UU Legislative Ministry of New Jersey, really, we're asking ourselves and fundraising right now, for example, to hire a lawyer and to write legislation that would impact racial justice in our community. And we're not just waiting to reflect on other people's legislation that already exists and to work with partner organizations. And I see all these statewide networks doing some of that long-haul work, and they're trying to be more coordinated. I think the UUA at one time had more of a centralized voice around that advocacy work on a federal level. And I think there's an opportunity to coordinate the statewide networks and to actually have that voice once again on the federal level and to model long-haul work. If it's all public witness and it's all in a social media soundbite, then everything hangs in that. If we're working for social justice on multiple fronts, it's much more powerful, much more powerful.
I see that we have gone over our time. One thing, because I know we did have a question about the difference of nominee and candidate that I just wanted to mention, is for the Presidential Search Committee, both Allison and Susan were nominated by us, and Susan right now, though, is still considered a nominee because she has to go through the petition process and getting churches signing on, and we wish you the best of luck with that. And for The View, we are looking forward to, the next 15 months. We hope that we can have both of our candidates on, throughout that time. And looking forward to all of the conversation that ensues. We just didn't have enough time this time. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I want to concur with what you both said. I think you both would be great presidents, and we're really lucky to have you giving all of this to the movement, so thank you.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.